person who has ever given you the credit that you deserve for that.
I must say that that's true, too. You know, there's a Hitchcock cult, particularly in France and England. And when you read these books by the cinema buffs over there, they talk about Hitchcock's wonderful inventiveness in killing off the heroine one-third of the way through the film, and killing her off in a shower where she's alone and unprotected, and doing this, that, and the other thing. And they don't seem to realize that all this is directly from the book, but Hitch does, and he said so in an interview in a book that was edited by Charles Higham, the film critic, some years ago. And I know that on television, frequently when he's asked about that film, he always mentions its source. And I think this is a very, very gentlemanly thing to do in a day when the auteur director reigns supreme and so many of them take sole and exclusive credit for everything that is up there on the screen.
Hear, hear. Our guest, Robert Bloch, and if you'd like to speak to him, give us a call. The telephone number is 985-5735 or 985-KPFK. And you may have a question, comment for Robert Bloch. Before we get to the phones, Walt, why don't you run down once more where and what the Fantasy Fair is, and some of the people are going to be there, and, excuse me, run it by again.
Fine, very quickly, it's at the Pasadena Hilton Hotel. That's at 150 South Robles. If you're not familiar, it's almost in the center of Pasadena. And, of course, Robert Bloch will be our guest of honor, and at our banquet on Saturday, we will be very royally roasting him. I'm trying to locate a good spit now to roast them on.
You have some of the names of the people who are going to be doing that, by the way. Do you know yet?
We just have about three. A couple of more are tentative. It is not easy to get a person to roast for the simple reason of one thing. They worry about possibly stepping on somebody, which you're supposed to do. The other thing is, can they do it justice? And I think in the back of their mind, the thought runs to them, well, what's going to happen? Can he take it? Has he got the sense of humor? Well, anybody would know that if you want a sense of humor, go see Bob Bloch. And I know that he
knows where to get one, yeah.
Loving everything that goes on.
Well, I must say, to give away one of my lines, my first thought was, if you think I want to make an enemy of the man who popularized Jack the Ripper, you're crazy.
Well, then you're putting Jack the Ripper down all the time. Don't you know why he did all these things? Somebody just told him it was a nice way to meet girls.
But not nice girls.
That was a rip-off if I ever heard it.
I think we'll go to the phones now and improve the dialogue. Hour 25, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. This is directed towards Mr. Bloch. And with regards to the golden age of television, how easy and how much fun was it working with both Rod Serling and Alfred Hitchcock on the half-hour programs that they had, which I think you had a little bit to do with writing some of the episodes?
Well, the two shows that I was most involved in at that time were the Hitchcock program and a series called Thriller. And in those days, it was very, very simple. They didn't have the committee system yet on television, at least not there. Over on the Universal lot, where both of these shows were perpetrated, they had the little bungalows. One of them was Hitchcock's bungalow, in which Joan Harrison and Norman Lloyd presided as producer and assistant producer. And one would go in there with a notion, or they'd call you in and say, we'd like to adapt one of your stories. And you'd sit down and talk, and promptly at 4 o'clock, they'd bring out the silver tea service and serve English high tea. It was all very gentlemanly, very polite.
You'd How go high home. Did they get?
It wasn't that kind of tea.
Oh.
Then you'd go home and write your story, and it was very simple. On the Thriller show, oftentimes, I remember, I would come in and say, I'd like to do such and such a story, a magazine, here it is, you want to read it? And they would read it, and say, go ahead. And I'd write a first draft, and that would be what was filmed, with the cooperation of such people as Boris Karloff and the other participants in that program, and Doug Benton, who was the associate producer, and William Fry, who was the head producer. It was really a pleasure, because all of these people on both of these programs were into fantasy and into the mystery field. They knew it, they appreciated, they knew how to do it, they hired the right actors, best cameramen and directors for it, and you could be assured of an excellent job. I would sit on the thriller rehearsals, and I remember in those days some of the fine old character actors that are gone now, people like Edgar Buchanan, George McCready. I'd sit there. I remember one script had a Latin invocation that George McCready was to read. And he was a fine professional, one of the members of the great acting family that dated back to the 1830s in this country, the McCready family. Mm. He came around the table to me. He said, "Now, I'm going to read that invocation. I want you to tell me, do I have the pronunciation of this Latin invocation correct?" Well, that's the kind of people these were. They were conscientious. And it was a great thrill. I didn't work on the Outer Limits show at all. I did do one or two night galleries, but I was pretty well occupied at that time between those shows and the first films that I was doing. But it was a wonderful era. It's changed now completely. Your script gets attention of about 25 people. I think in one network they are now mimeographing 27 copies to send around. Now you must remember, and I say this in all honesty, that 27 people occupy 27 different jobs. And if they get this script, they don't say anything about it, just let it pass, somebody's going to ask, what do we hire this guy for? So most of them have to come up with suggestions or contradictions or objections.
Okay, we have a full board, Bert, so I'm going to move on, but thank you for calling.
Thank you.
KPFK, you're on the air.
First of all, the only Robert Block story that I know of that exists in radio is a Dimension X called Almost Human. I would like information in a couple of books, if possible, which have not been republished and do not appear in your bibliography anywhere. Well, there are actually three. The Scarf, which I have heard is your favorite book, The Star Stalker, and a book called Deadbeat.
All right. My first novel was The Scarf. It was published by Dial Press in 1947, reprinted in Avon paperbacks. It's been reprinted since several times. I think the latest edition, however, is a Corgi book, which came out 2 years ago in England. The Star Stalker is a novel about the silent movie days in Hollywood. My title for it was Colossal, but somebody decided to put that other title on it, which means it's neither fish nor fowl. Most people didn't know whether it was a science fiction thing because of its title, or a mystery because it had a rather sinister-looking female on the cover. That was published by Pyramid in 1967 as a paperback, and is being reprinted, I think, in France and in England currently. And the third book, The Deadbeat, was a Simon & Schuster novel, which appeared in 1960. It was reprinted in paperback by Popular Library, and I think it's had 7 or 8 foreign editions, but it's not currently in print.
Okay, I'd like to say in closing for all of you who have read the book that I am glad you are giving it the old college try tonight.
All right, thank you. Good night. Hour 25, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Sam Frank calling for Mr.
Yes,
Block.
Yes, Sam, go ahead.
Mr. Block, late last year in a horror film class I was taking at USC, I saw a film that you had scripted called The Cabinet of Caligari with Dan O'Herlihy and Glynis Johns. And I wanted to ask you about that film. What were your intentions in writing that film?
My intentions in writing that film...
Psychological intentions.
Yes, my intentions were to present a completely realistic story, which only in the last few moments of film would be disclosed to be the fantasies of a woman who was suffering from mental illness. And I wrote it that way. Mm-hmm. The director of the film was a very ambitious man. During the course of the film, he managed also to become the producer. And I didn't realize that he also wanted to become the writer. He immediately paraphrased all of my dialogue, changing it, making it very, the phrase I suppose is artsy-craftsy, and gave away the notion that this couldn't possibly be realistic right up front. He then went to the Writers Guild and claimed co-credit, and the Writers Guild threw him out, which is a moral victory, but it didn't help the film any. I'm very, very disappointed because I had hoped that if the film had been carried out according to my intentions, that it would be a sort of a tribute to the original Caligari.
Well, you know, in watching the film, I felt very disturbed. When the ending came in, it seemed to me sort of a cheat, a trick. I didn't know whether it was your intention or the director's, but I felt really cheated because this woman who was put through this nightmare, and we're never let on to the fact that she is a mental patient. Caligari plays all kinds of games with her, and I felt afterwards, well, what hypocrisy on the part of the doctor. He has her coming and going, and he sets up rules for her to play by, and then when she plays by them, he turns around and says, well, here's a new set of rules. And when the fantasy happened at the end with the babies being burned in the incinerator, or the fetuses, I wondered, what's the point of that? One of the few powerful things in the film for me was the very last shot, which showed O'Herlihy on a hilltop overlooking the asylum as though he were God looking on a whole bunch of little puppets. And everybody in the class remarked on the power, the disturbing power of that shot. But several others felt like I did that it was something of a cheat, and that the doctor, that we wondered what kind of comment was being made on psychiatry and what the thematic intent was with such a seemingly schizophrenic ending.
Well, I intended to pay homage to the original Caligari, in which, as you may remember, the doctor is described as insane by the patient. Later turns out to be quite sane, and it's all a matter of a patient's fantasy. I reversed that, and in my ending, as originally written, you were quite sure that this poor woman had been victimized, but she had triumphed and escaped, and the doctor was mentally ill. Oh. And this is a comment on psychiatry, I must say it is.
Why did the director decide to change it and make it such a schizoid ending?
Yeah, I think he wanted to be an auteur. I think his main purpose was to try to obtain screen credit for it so that he could say that he was a producer, director, and writer of this film.
Okay, Sam, we're going to have to move on. Thank you for calling. KPFK, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, go ahead. You're on the air with Bob Block.
Yeah, relating to Mr. Block, I had the privilege of waiting on him about a year ago in a certain local electronics store, and we hurriedly got into a discussion about H.P. Lovecraft, and I was wondering, as I sit here with a copy of The Haunter of the Dark in front of me, I was wondering if he has heard yet, or maybe even gotten involved in any attempts to put any of Lovecraft's work into films that actually depict anything like what he wrote.
Well, you know, that's been a dream of mine. It's been a dream of a number of other people that are interested in Lovecraft's work, but it's never come to pass. The films that have been made, of course, as I'm sure you know, don't follow his work very closely, and as far as I know, nobody intends to do so. I've just arranged to read the galley proofs of a new novel that I wrote, which is a Lovecraftian novel, which will be published in the early part of January by Pinnacle. It's called Strange Eons. And it deals with, it's a Lovecraftian novel that is about Lovecraft and all of his...
And even death may die.
Yes, absolutely. That's the theme of the book. And it's, something that might possibly get on the screen someday. If it does, I'd like to have a hand in it and try and keep it close to the original concepts that Lovecraft created.
Didn't I read someplace that you killed H.P. Lovecraft and he returned the favor?
That's the story I was quoting.
That's the story. I killed him in a story called The Shambler from the Stars and used him as the principal character. So he asked if he could do the same to me and wrote The Haunter of the Dark, which he dedicated to me, and he killed me off.
How you feeling?
Okay, thank you very much for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a two-hour film for CBS, a movie for television, called Club Pacific, which is a mystery, and I'm just completing the first draft. Then I have a project, which is very hush-hush, that I'm working on with George Pal for a theatrical film, which I've got to do a lengthy treatment. I have three collections coming out in the next 6 months, and those have required a little attention, too. And six new short stories. And in my spare time, I'm working as a meter maid.
In the middle and late 50s, you wrote one of the sections of criticism on the science fiction novel. It was published by Advent. Some of the others were, let me see, Alfred Bester, Robert Heinlein, a couple of others. In that, you talk about, excuse me, and remember this was the climate of the late 50s, you were talking about the fact that science fiction didn't have much of a purpose beyond ray guns and space opera, and then it did discover social conscience, and had some interesting things to say about the worlds around it. If you were writing that article today, what would you be saying about science fiction?
I would say that science fiction is now doing quite a job in terms of social criticism, but also it's become very self-conscious, and there are many writers now that prefer to call what they are doing speculative fiction. And they are indulging in what they call experimental writing. Now, I am all for this, but I must remind some of these people, and I did at the World Science Fiction Convention in 1973, where I was guest of honor, so this is not a snide remark, I did this publicly, that if they know anything about science, if they know anything about experiments, but experiments often fail, and they have to except the fact that they don't always succeed with these stories, which are very introspective, very subjective, and use the techniques of James Joyce, of Proust, of Kafka. And they're not quite that innovative, because all of these things were done in the 1920s and early 30s. I'm for it, but I don't think this is where science fiction is at or should be. I think science fiction still should have some relationship with the outside world rather than be an exercise in self-examination or projection of one's own fantasies.
Do you find that you're having trouble getting certain of your stories published because the publishers expect certain things from you?
Well, I have not really run into that. I've received requests for certain types of stories. If I want to do them, I do them. If not, I just turn them down. But I can't say that I've had any great problem along those lines. I've been very, very lucky, you know, to stay in this field as long as I have and go with the various trends and duck the punches. And I'm very grateful to the people that continue to read me through all these years.
Have you found new friends in the science fiction field in recent years with some of the newer writers?
Oh, absolutely. And there are many, many people that I respect and admire greatly. In fact, this has always been the reason why I've been fond of fandom as well as of writing per se. The opportunity it's given me to meet people. And out here, it's been so wonderful. You know, I've always been a film buff. To come out here and meet and work with some of the people that I'd seen up on the screen. Where else but in Hollywood could something happen like what happened to me last night? I picked up the telephone, and the voice at the other end, this will mean nothing to you, but believe me, it means something to me. The voice at the other end said, "Hello, this is Yakima Cannet."
Huh.
Now, Yakima Cannet was one of the great stunt men of the 1920s and early 1930s. And when I heard that voice, my memory went back 50 years to a time when I saw him as a star in a picture called Rex, King of the Wild Horses. To imagine 50 years later, this man who I saw as a kid is actually, he's still alive, he's working on autobiography, and his agent had called and asked for some information. He'd forgotten something about a picture. Wondered if I remembered the title, and I was able to supply that title, so he'd called up to thank me. To think that this contact had been made, that all of these things that were so vivid and so important a part of my childhood are still alive somewhere. I would never have met or seen or heard or talked or worked with any of these people were it not for science fiction. And it's another reason I have to be so grateful.
You know, as a matter of fact, Yakima Cannet, obviously I'm now discovering how to pronounce his name, is not a name that people haven't heard. He's been well.
He should be. You know, he's the man who taught Duke Wayne how to ride, and Duke Wayne uses Cannet's walk. And he doubled for Duke Wayne all through the 30s in those Republic pictures.
Huh. Very strange thing. It's a shame that I didn't know about this, because last Wednesday night, I believe it was, went out to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to a packed house. Charlton Heston emceeing and a tribute to
Yakima Canute.
Oh, that's great. Did they mention?
They showed clip after clip
That's wonderful.
All of the great stunts. The one stunt that has never been matched since, and that was from original John Ford's Stagecoach.
Yes.
Where he jumps to the head of six horses. He's an Indian. He's shot. He falls down in between those lead horses and turns loose and slides all the way under as the stagecoach goes over him. Now, this is something that takes absolutely perfect timing. If you do it three times, one or three times, you're going to be so badly banged up or killed because you cannot judge it and hold it right there. And just the slightest bit of an indication, one way or the other, you're trampled by horses and run over by the stagecoach. It was a marvelous evening. All the film clips and other people there who were saluting him, and he was a very happy man that night, but not nearly as happy as we were in the audience saluting him.
I have one more question for Bob Block. You have known so many people and done so many things in the past that it must be a little bit disturbing sometimes to be asked to be so reminiscent all the time, and yet you're still very active, all the projects you're now working on. What is it that you're looking forward to?
More of the same. I just want to. I remember Boris Karloff used to say, "I'm shameless. As long as they ask me, I'll be happy to respond." And by golly, he did. You know, when he was in a wheelchair with his leg in a brace and one lung collapsed, he still was a trooper, because his life was performing, entertaining, communicating, and he appreciated the opportunity, and I always have in my small way to be.
What are the proportions of your life between entertaining the people that you talk to in groups and so on, your role as Toastmaster and your writing? How do you separate the two, or do you have to?
I don't think I have to very much. I just, all of them are forms of communication, and to me, writing is communication. I spoke about being afraid of audiences, but I dearly love to communicate with people, and I try to do so in every medium that I possibly can.
Do you have any messages you like to hide underneath the banter?
Sometimes.
Any world-moving ideas that you're trying to express?
Well, you'll find them in my stories. I don't think any of them particularly original or particularly significant, but I do sometimes express my views or opinions.
And they'll probably become pronounced again when Robert Block is the guest of honor at the Fantasy Fair. It's September 22nd, 3rd, and 4th at the Pasadena Hilton at 150 South. Actually, that's a misprint, Walt. It's Los Robles, or Los Robles, if you want
Los
to pronounce
Robles.
It properly. It means the Oaks. It's in Pasadena. And along with Robert Block, there'll be people like Fritz Leiber, A.E. Van Vogt, Don Walheim, H.O. Gold, Steve Golden, Kathleen Sky, George Clinton Johnson, Marion Zimmer Bradley, Alan Dean Foster, a particular favorite of Mitch's, Morris Scott Dolan's will be there, Randall Garrett, Don Glute, and a few others. And Don Glute, by the way, along with Bill Warren, will be our guest next week on Hour 25 when we switch, not all that far, to horror films.
And the telephone number for further information about
the Fantasy Fair is
337-7947. That's in the 213 area code. 337-7947. And there you will either talk to Bill Crawford or Peggy Crawford. They can give you all the information.
And we will be back live next week. Is there anything you want to say about the tape, Mitchell, or is it all self-contained? Or?
Yes, there is. This is a tape I mentioned that I would like to get on as soon as possible because I'd recently reread the story, The Sentinel, by Arthur C. Clarke. And I find that the story is the best example of a certain kind of sense of wonder and a certain kind of view of the universe that I've seen. It's not original. I mean, that is, it's been done a lot of times, this kind of a story. But the whole story has a certain attitude and view of things that I find very refreshing. You know, it's mainline science fiction and its attitude toward the wonder of the universe, and especially that last page, which has condensed within it some of the most evocative writing I've heard in a long time. And then, just briefly to blow that horn once again, this reading I did a few months before the release of 2001, And I was happy to see that Kubrick had picked the same music I did when the picture came out.
And so before we go to that music and the tape...
I forgot to mention, for a lot of people who don't know it, that this is the original story from which 2001 took off, the motion picture.
Robert Bloch, thank you very much for doing Hour 25 tonight.
It's a great really pleasure to be here.
And glad we got a chance to talk to you. And Walt, we'll be seeing you next weekend at the Fantasy Fair.
Let's hope so.
So, I'm Mitch... No, he's Mitch Harding. I'm Mike Hodel. This is Hour 25.
Who's Mitch Harding?
I don't know. Somebody is. And we'll figure it out and give you a report next week. Good night.